Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ News and East County Magazine with emerging details about the dramatic rescue Saturday of Hannah Anderson, the 16-year-old Lakeside teen who was abducted by James Lee DiMaggio, a 40-year-old family friend. Hannah is safe and has been reunited with her father after being found in the Frank Church Wilderness in Idaho, an area also known as the River of No Return. According to San Diego Sheriff Bill Gore, Hannah was taken against her will and did not know about the tragedy that befell her mother and brother, who were found dead in a fire at DiMaggio's Boulevard home. Authorities have found that Hannah's mother, Christina Anderson, was murdered by being struck on the head. DNA tests identified the second body as her 8-year-old brother, Ethan Anderson. Sheriff Gore, in an interview with 10 News, said it's clear from information we have received that she was under extreme duress. She was taken out of the county, out of the state, clearly against her will. According to Sheriff Gore, DiMaggio was killed in a shootout after he fired at least one shot at deputies. A friend of Hannah's has said that she was creeped out by DiMaggio, who told her he had a crush on her. She had recently been trying to avoid being alone with DiMaggio, said her friend, but Hannah did not tell her parents about her concerns. An Amber Alert was issued after her disappearance, sparking a search across multiple states, Mexico and Canada. The alert had not yet been extended to Idaho, however, and it was a tip from a group of horseback riders that broke the case wide open. One of those horseback riders was a retired Idaho sheriff. The riders have reported that Hannah seemed scared. DiMaggio told the group that he and Hannah were hiking to the Salmon River, but they were going in the wrong direction. They also had newly purchased camping gear that was far too light for the weather and the conditions, and they had pitched the tent on a ridgeline, a dangerous location due to lightning. They also had a gray cat with them. All of these things made them seem out of place, according to the witnesses. After seeing a news story about the Amber Alert, one of the hikers alerted authorities, who found DiMaggio's car hidden under a mound of branches. A massive manhunt ensued, including searchers on foot, on horseback, and by air. The search was made even more difficult in the rugged terrain due to smoke from several nearby wildfires. In Idaho, authorities have said that they waited until Hannah was separated from DiMaggio to confront him. According to Sheriff Gore, DiMaggio had a shoulder-mounted weapon and fired at least one shot before he himself was shot and killed. Authorities had feared that DiMaggio could have explosives. A friend of DiMaggio's had speculated that he may have intended to commit suicide, following in the footsteps of his father, an ex-convict who served time for assault and later vanished after a second bizarre incident in which he held hostages, including the daughter of a girlfriend. DiMaggio reportedly set fire to his own home on the anniversary of his father's disappearance and died on the anniversary of his father's suicide. Hannah has been taken to a hospital in Idaho for evaluation and has now been reunited with her father, Brett Anderson. Though mourning the loss of his wife and son, Hannah's father has expressed relief that something good came out of something indescribably horrible and that now is a time for healing for the family.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ's East County Magazine show, and my newsmaker today is Aaron Hunt with the California Wolf Center in Julian. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
This facility has done an amazing job of bringing back from near extinction a particular breed of wolf. We're going to tell you more about that later. There are several thousand gray wolves across the United States today, but Erin is here with some very troubling news today. She's going to tell us about a National Day of Action on August 14th to stand up for gray wolves because the federal government's U.S. Department of Interior and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are pushing to delist gray wolves. from protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Erin, tell us what's happening.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to delist gray wolves throughout the lower 48 states.
So they would no longer be endangered or even on the threatened list. What would happen?
Management would be handed over to each individual state where wolves are found, and the states have various different attitudes towards gray wolves. Some of them are opposed to having gray wolves in their states. So this proposal, if it goes through, has the potential to put the brakes on wolf recovery. Wolf recovery is one of the most successful endangered species recovery efforts in our nation's history. And we believe it would be premature to remove protections for gray wolves at this time.
This could even open the door to hunting them by helicopters, as we've seen done in Alaska with Alaskan gray wolves, correct?
Well, there are areas of this country that have excellent wolf habitat, but either have very small populations of gray wolves or don't have any populations of gray wolves. So to consider wolves recovered in areas where they're not even found is premature. So it would prevent wolves from recolonizing those areas that have good habitat. In the areas where we do have healthy populations of wolves, most likely effect would be to reduce those populations and potentially even eliminate populations.
Now, one of the most disturbing aspects of this story is an interview that you have done with a scientist, Dr. Vucetich, who was one of 16 scientists whose work was cited to try to justify this proposal for the delisting. And yet he and these other scientists have now signed a letter critiquing the arguments and saying that the federal government is effectively stacking the deck of what should be an independent peer review process and excluding those scientists who are really the top wolf experts. What can you tell us about your findings from your interview with Dr. Vucetich?
Well, this is a big concern because the way science works is that experts, peers, must review other scientists' work. That's how science gets better. It's how we find new information and how we continually improve.
Correct.
So to tell scientists that no, you can't make judgments and you can't critique another scientist's work is exactly the opposite of the way science is supposed to function. In this particular case, it's potential evidence of stacking the deck against science. If an independent peer review panel is handpicked and scientists who have opinions that they have expressed that have been against delisting gray wolves, and they're excluded from this peer review panel, it gives the impression that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is trying to handpick experts that will support their case for delisting instead of experts who will give an honest and well-qualified evaluation of U.S. Fish and Wildlife's
very,
proposal.
Very troubling. What is fueling this? Are there special interests at play that are trying to get the wolves eradicated?
Well, wolves are a very polarizing species. They invoke passionate support, but they also evoke fear and anger sometimes. We are not about continuing the wolf wars mentality. You know, we're really trying to find common ground and solutions. So, we don't necessarily like to point to anyone to kind of place blame anywhere in particular. But what we are trying to do is to share the facts about wolves and to share the facts about this delisting proposal and to ask people to speak up and to tell U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that they want gray wolves to remain on the landscape for future generations.
Now, you've mentioned that you were trying to work with ranching interests, for example, to sort of put your money where your mouth is and give them some examples of ways that livestock and wolves can coexist. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. A core part of our mission is providing funding for coexistence measures. These are things that prevent conflicts between wolves and human activities, and that includes livestock grazing. Many of the techniques that we fund are designed to prevent conflicts before they occur, and each time we're successful preventing those conflicts, it increases tolerance for wolves and other wild predators on the landscape. Some of the specific examples are funding range riders. These are people who go out and they can be with the livestock. They create a human presence in that area. And because wolves are naturally shy around humans, that alone is enough to deter them from entering an area where livestock may be grazing. We also fund fladry. That's a visual deterrent that keeps wolves from entering an area. Predator-proof fencing, which excludes predators from an area where you may be housing livestock. Livestock guardian dogs, and some creative and technologically advanced husbandry techniques that end up resulting in healthier livestock and preventing those conflicts. rights.
Now, there's a national poll, I understand, that shows support for protecting the wolves.
Absolutely. The majority of U.S. citizens support wolf recovery. There are some vocal opponents to wolf recovery, but we're encouraging people who, if you are one of those majority of Americans who supports wolf recovery, you have an opportunity through September 11th, 2013, to provide public comment to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's very important. Let's repeat that. There is a deadline for public comment on this of September 11th, and you can find a link for how to submit your public comments at the California Wolf Recovery Center website, which is?
It's www.californiawolfcenter.org. You have a chance to stand up for wolves and tell U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the job is not done.
Okay, and you can also, we'll be posting that also at the www.eastcountymagazine.org site as well. Wednesday, August 14th is a National Day of Public Action to Protect Wolves. Tell us what you have in mind for that.
A large number of conservation organizations have come together to partner to organize this National Day of Action, August 14th. And we're asking everyone to wear gray, talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, feel free to howl, but let people know that wolves are important. They have an important role in our environment, and you can take that opportunity to tell not just your friends and neighbors, but also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that wolf recovery is important and the job is not done.
Yes. Now, as we've mentioned, there are several thousand gray wolves across the continental United States. This delisting would delist them in all 48 lower states, which is quite astonishing. One bright spot is that the Mexican gray wolf has been excluded from that delisting, and this is one of the species that you're working with at your facility in Julian. Tell us about your efforts there.
The Mexican gray wolf is the most genetically distinct subspecies, and they are the rarest. There are only about 75 of them alive in the wild today.
And at one point it was down to 7, right?
We got within 7 unrelated individuals of that subspecies being extinct. The only reason we have Mexican gray wolves alive on the landscape today is because of captive breeding efforts of facilities like the California Wolf Center. So we host and breed Mexican gray wolves in captivity, and some of our individuals are selected for release into the wild. They're being released into Arizona and New Mexico.
How successful has that been? Have they been protected and kept safe once they were released?
Well, they've been protected, but human-caused mortality is still the number one threat to the survival of Mexican gray wolves. So this is still an uphill battle, and the job is certainly not done.
Because the rancher or someone who sees it doesn't know that it's an endangered subspecies, maybe.
Part of the issue is confusion between Mexican gray wolves and coyotes, mm-hmm. although one of the things we try to do is provide educational information to help people identify those two unique mm-hmm. individual mm-hmm. animals. But there is also illegal poaching, hunting, trapping that does cause some mortality for Mexican gray wolves.
So they could stumble into a coyote trap, for example. Now, in California, we don't have any wolves. Is that correct?
Correct. In December of 2011, a wolf named OR7, or nicknamed Journey, crossed from Oregon into California and became our first wild wolf here in almost 90 years.
Wow. So they were here historically.
Yes, absolutely. Wolves are native to the state of California, but they were completely wiped out here in the 1920s. And so OR7's Journey into California represents the very beginning stages of wolf recovery here in our home state. And that's one of the main reasons why this delisting proposal is so premature, because we have areas like the Pacific West, which includes California, where wolves are not yet recovered. So to remove federal protections from them puts the brakes on wolf recovery and potentially might prevent wolves from reclaiming areas of excellent wolf habitat where they could survive and could provide those ecological benefits that those top predators
do. Now, let's talk about the ecological benefits of large predators such as wolves. When they're removed from the ecosystem, what are some of the negative things that can happen?
Well, we tend to see their prey species overpopulate.
So deer.
And with wolves in particular, their natural prey are large ungulates or hoofed animals like deer, elk. When these populations grow too large, they tend to overgraze native vegetation. And that impacts habitat that many other species of animals depend on. It impacts the vegetation itself. So we see trees like willow and aspen, in particular riparian or river ecosystems, are negatively affected by overgrazing. It can mm-hmm. even impact the water quality.
There you go.
And that has impacts throughout a watershed.
And I would think for ranchers who do use open range lands on, say, Bureau of Land Management land, that actually could mean less foraging material, less grasses for their sheep or cattle to graze on.
It can have impacts there as well. And it's important that people understand that there are ways to coexist. There are ways to have healthy rangeland for livestock to graze, as well as healthy populations of wild ungulates and wild predators.
Now let's talk a little bit about the California Wolf Center, which is right here in Julian. It's an amazing place. Besides the Mexican gray wolves that you actually are breeding there for repopulation in the wild, I understand you also have other wolves and some educational things. Tell us about it.
We do. We have an ambassador pack of Alaskan gray wolves that we keep to help people understand about wolves in the wild. They're ambassadors for wolves in the wild, and they can speak more articulately for wolves than we ever will be able to. So people can come and visit and learn about mm-hmm. wolves and the important
Take
role
photos.
That they play in mm-hmm. the ecosystem. And certainly cameras are welcome. So education and outreach is something that we do, not just at our conservation center, but throughout the state of California. We're also mm-hmm. active in providing this proactive non-lethal funding for techniques that prevent conflicts between wolves and human activities. We host and conduct research to help us better understand wolf behavior, ecology, and what we can better do to protect them in the wild.
Very good. Well, the website again to get more information about how you can visit the California Wolf Center, how you can submit your public comments before September 11th about the proposal to delist wolves from the Federal Endangered Species Protection, and also learn more about the August 14th National Day of Action, you can visit www.californiawolfcenter.org. Erin, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Arielle Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's lineup of activities includes art, music, history, sports, nature, wine, and more. First up, tickets are available for a couple more days for the August 17th 6th Annual Heart of Mount Helix, with the emphasis on ART. This event, which runs Saturday night from 5:30 to 10 p.m., is a fundraiser to benefit the Mount Helix Park Foundation. The entertainment headliner is the Mighty and Untouchables. Other musicians featured are the Jan Connor Trio, Lillian Palmer, and David Maldonado. Besides the live music, there will be tastings from several well-known restaurants, visual art demonstrations, silent and live auctions, and a perfect sunset. Silent auction prizes to bid on include a bay cruise for 10 on a private yacht, lunch for 2 at Thornton Winery by way of helicopter to the winery, and the ultimate San Diego safari at Lions, Tigers, and Bears. Tickets for the 6th annual Heart of Mount Helix event are pre-sale only. Sales will end August 14th. The Young Actors Theater is presenting Grease, which opens this weekend beginning on Friday and running through Sunday the 18th. It continues next weekend from August 22nd through the 25th at Encore Theater in Spring Valley, evoking Rydell High's senior class of 1959 in this rollicking musical. The shows are at 7 p.m. each day, with Saturday and Sunday 2 p.m. matinees. Tickets can be purchased online at yatsandiego.org. San Pasqual Winery is offering a paint and palette event on Wednesday, August 14th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Paint, sip, and enjoy. Find your inner Picasso as you paint and have a ton of fun. They provide everything you need, including a 16-inch by 20-inch canvas, supplies, art apron, and step-by-step instructions by a local artist. Just bring yourself, no art experience required. For more information and to reserve your space, go to paintandpalette.com. Also at the San Pasqual Winery's new tasting room on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa, enjoy live music featuring the Mercury Street Blues Band on Saturday, August 17th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. They play a variety of music, jazz, blues, folk, and rock. Wine by the glass, cheese and crackers, and dessert are available. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis. Mission Trails Regional Park in San Carlos will be hosting a summer twilight walk and owl prowl as dusk sets in on Saturday night, August 17th. Advance registration is required. Guests will gather at Bushy Hill parking lot across from the Kumeyaay Lake Campground entry. The walk begins at 7:30 p.m. and ends at 9:30 p.m. The Alpine Historical Society is holding their special presentation, Witness to Gettysburg, on August 18th from 2 to 3:45 p.m. at the Alpine Women's Club in Alpine. Miss Hattie Elizabeth Turner, played by Annette Hubble, tells how a town of 2,400 citizens coped with the 30,000 casualties following the epic Battle of Gettysburg. San Diego State University is set for Aztec Fan Fest, formerly known as Aztec Family Day, scheduled for Saturday, August 17th at Qualcomm Stadium. The event features Tailgate Town, a Fan Fest scrimmage, and a Meet the Team autograph session. Gates open at 3:30 p.m., and admission is free. The event begins with Tailgate Town, which includes appearances by San Diego State University players, coaches, and sponsors, as well as the San Diego State University Marching Aztecs and Cheer Team. At Cosmos Coffee Cafe in La Mesa, Jeff Berkeley and Jeffrey Joe will be performing on Thursday, August 15th at 7 p.m. Float in the pool while watching the family movie Brave this Wednesday, August 14th at the Salvation Army Croc Center. They call it Dive In Movie. The movie begins at 7:30 and the first 50 guests will receive inner tubes. The Croc Center is located on University Avenue in San Diego, just outside of La Mesa. Brouhaha Comedy has a comedy show every Wednesday at Haritna Mediterranean Restaurant on El Cajon Boulevard in La Mesa. The show runs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. This Wednesday's show features international headliner Kurt Swan, and the mixer starts at 6 p.m. with the show beginning at 7:30. On Tuesday, August 13th at 6 p.m., as part of their People Who Cook program, the Julian Public Library will be featuring frozen desserts with Jeff Jeremy from Jeremy's on the Hill. And a summer mixer where you can meet and greet with local businessmen and women in East County is hosted by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce. The event is free for chamber members and $10 for non-members. The summer mixer will start at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 14th, at the Holiday Inn, 8000 Parkway Drive. All of these events and activities and more can be found in our festival and events section and in our calendar at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County.
This is Janice Mork, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. This week, I'm interviewing Alex Montoya, manager of Latino Affairs of the San Diego Padres. Alex spoke at this year's Cuyameca College commencement. He is also missing three limbs since birth and has been an inspiration to people by triumphing over his disability. So, Alex, how were you chosen to speak at Cuyameca?
I was fortunate that about a year ago, the leadership at Cuyameca College actually went to a breakfast for the East County Chamber of Commerce. And that breakfast happened to be held at the Hall of Champions in Balboa Park. I was the keynote speaker there. They heard me, they liked my message, and invited me to speak at the commencement.
What was it like coming to America at a young age?
Coming to the U.S. was absolutely a new world. It was at times daunting, but really it was refreshing and exhilarating too, because even though it was a new language and a new culture, I realized that there were boundless opportunities within the U.S. that really allowed a person to dream large and aim large and really pursue whatever their passion and their dreams were.
Where did you pursue your degree at?
I pursued my undergraduate degree and received my undergraduate degree at the University of Notre Dame, where I received my bachelor's in communications, and then I received my master's in sport management through the University of San Francisco on their satellite campus in Orange County.
Very cool. And what sports are you passionate about?
Really, I love all sports, but I'm most passionate about baseball. Baseball is the language of really all of humanity. It's a very fair and very beautiful sport. I literally learned the English language when I moved to the U.S., by watching baseball and watching it on TV, and I quickly saw that it was America's pastime. It's played on beautiful fields in beautiful cathedrals known as ballparks, and was something that really stayed with me my entire life.
Baseball must mean a lot to you. What are your goals now?
To try to be the best baseball executive that I can be, to try to continue to expand my writing and speaking in the community, and really to just try to continue to show people that no matter what your obstacles are, or no matter what your difficulties are, there are always ways around them. And when you have a disability, you need to work harder and be a little more creative with some things and maybe be more persistent with some things, but there is always a way to triumph.
Thank you for sharing your inspiring story with us. I'm sure it'll be a hit with many listeners.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is a public service announcement from CAL FIRE. One out of every four fires is started by arson. When an arsonist sets a fire, everyone pays. Arson fires destroy homes, businesses, communities, wilderness, and lives. They cost our community considerably in fire losses, firefighting expenses, and higher insurance premiums. They also tie up fire crews and equipment needlessly. CAL FIRE asks that the public help by reporting arsonists. A reward of up to $5,000 for each arrest that leads to a conviction is available. If you see an act of arson, try to remember everything you saw. Then contact CAL FIRE or your local fire department.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
A state court has sided with a San Diego County ordinance that is bringing a bumper crop of boutique wineries to the backcountry. The California Appellate Court affirmed a lower court ruling, which upheld the legality of the 2010 winery initiative spearheaded by Supervisor Diane Jacob. Barring an appeal to the state Supreme Court, the decision marks the conclusion of a three-year legal challenge. This is a great victory for vintners, wine lovers, and the region's farm economy, said Jacob, who is vice chairwoman of the Board of Supervisors. By reducing costly and burdensome regulations, she said, the ordinance has uncorked a new collection of boutique businesses. In Ramona, a federally designated viticulture area, there are now 20 tasting rooms today, compared to just one when the ordinance was approved. The ordinance was crafted to regulate and encourage vintner operations through a tiered permit system that is tied to the amount of wine that they produce and the size of the operation. It's made it easier and less expensive for smaller wineries to open on-site retail outlets and tasting rooms. The three-judge appellate court panel rejected a lawsuit filed by the San Diego Citizenry Group, which was largely centered on an argument that the county failed to properly assess the environmental impact of the ordinance. Supervisor Jacob is now leading efforts to craft a similar ordinance to encourage microbreweries, cheese-making operations, and other agriculture-based ecotourism ventures in rural areas of East County. The Board of Supervisors has agreed to explore the issue in the future.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
My name is Oday Youssef. You are here listening to the Calvin Corner, where we give you as much information as we can about the Calvin community here in East County and across San Diego. Today I'm here with Father Michael Bozzi of the St. Peter Chaldean Catholic Cathedral in El Cajon of East County. Father Michael, thank you for being on the show today.
You're welcome.
You're very well known in our church, of course, and in the community, honored greatly. My first question to you is, who are the Chaldeans and what are they doing in San Diego?
Chaldeans are from the ancient culture of Mesopotamia, and Ur of Chaldea is the cradle of civilization according to the history. Even their name was given to the, today is called Persian Gulf, but it was the Sea of Chaldea. Throughout the history, they are mentioned in the history, half of the Mesopotamia was called Chaldea. Chaldeans are as a nation of 4,000 years before Christ, as a people. But they ruled Mesopotamia and they ruled all over the Middle East from 621 BC all the way to 539 BC. When you open the first page of the Bible, you will see that there are Tigris, Euphrates, and that is the country where the Bible starts to speak about the beginning of the people. And then about Chaldeans, we have in Genesis chapter 11, verse 27, God called Abraham to leave his hometown, Ur of Chaldea, and go establish the Jewish nation. These are the Chaldeans, so the cousins. And later, Chaldeans, 539 BC, they were under the control of Persians. And when the Christianity came, spread, Chaldeans were the first to become Catholics, Christian Catholics. And in year 2000, anniversary of 2000 years jubilee, we celebrated a church built 68 AD. It is today in between Baghdad and Babylon. Today, Chaldeans are almost 800,000 in the world.
How many, in numbers-wise, are Chaldeans in San Diego County and East County specifically?
Yeah. We have 40,000 Chaldeans. But in El Cajon, every four people, one of them is Chaldean. We have 25,000 in El Cajon. Second city will be La Mesa and Spring Valley. And the rest are scattered. You know why? Sometimes the family goes to live around their businesses. So we have 40,000 of them and maybe more now because every week they are running from that persecution. And the rest of the Chaldeans are scattered in other states, especially Detroit. We have 150,000 of them there in Detroit. If you ask why San Diego, because the same weather of our hometown there in Nineveh. Majority of Chaldeans are from the region of Nineveh. You remember Nineveh in the Bible, Jonah and the whale? That's Nineveh. Here in San Diego, 1951 was the first person to come here as a doctor to come and study from Baghdad. And then 1974, I arrived here from Vatican. I was studying there, and there were only 100 family. Then I went to Wisconsin to study. Then I came back. Around 1985, I came here to start, and since then I am here as a pastor of the community.
Thank you, Father Michael.
You're welcome.
For that information. Father, can you explain the history of the Chaldean language, Aramaic, and the differences in how it spread in its history?
Our language is Aramaic in modern aspect of it. And Aramaic language started from almost 1800 BC in north of Mesopotamia. And today, everybody speak Aramaic. And I wanted to know, and we are proud of it, that every Chaldean either is bilingual or trilingual or more. Why? Because everybody speaks Aramaic at home, and like you do with your family. English is our main language. We write in it. And those whom they grew up back home, we had to study Arabic. So that means that's why I say the trilingual. And if some of them, they pass through European languages, like I myself, I study in Rome, I have Italian language too. But there are some other people, they went in Greece and they learn a Greek language. So most of the people are either bilingual, trilingual, or more. But Aramaic is the main language for our liturgy in our churches. And the same language of Jesus Christ. I teach it in Cuyama College. Since 1989, I am teaching Aramaic language two semesters in fall and in spring.
One thing that is important in the Chaldean culture was the first Holy Communion for over 100 boys and girls. How important to the Chaldean community is religion?
Chaldeans are all Christian Catholics. Everybody is family oriented. And there are three times when they celebrate in their family for their children. Number one is the baptism. Number two is the first communion. And number three is their wedding. And I had last Sunday 187 boys and girls. For 9 months, we taught them how to learn their faith, how to practice their faith. And just in parenthesis, I could tell you what happened for those communicants. Many of them, neighbors called me, they stole when they were children, balls or bicycles and all that. Everybody has to return when they go to confession to to return it back, otherwise they are in trouble. So being family-oriented, you will find out, for example, they are celebrating that birthday like your cousins. And not only the family, but all the community they come to share together. They're very close to each other.
Father Michael, our culture is definitely diverging with the American culture as we come from Iraq.
It has to. Except one thing. When we came here, we have to be American. And each Chaldean is the best American. And that's my intention to build in everybody to become the best American citizen. Because this country gave us a lot. In the beginning, they have little problems for money-wise to arrange their life. But I have committees, many, many of those committees, to introduce those are newcomers to the American way. We take them to the schools. We take them to immigration area. After they settle down after 1 year, and you will find them, they become the best citizen, American citizen in the area here.
And what message would you say to non-Chaldeans who are living as neighbors with Chaldeans?
Yeah, when we came here, everybody thought coming from Iraq, you are Muslim or you are this or that. We are not. Islam came to us in 6th century, entered to Iraq. We were Christian and we stayed Christian in spite of invasion of the Arabs and Islam to Iraq. Today, Christians are persecuted by Muslims in Iraq. I'm sorry to say it. And that's why we have almost every year more than average 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 people coming, running from persecution. Because they killed bishop, they killed three priests, they killed many deacons, and they are destroying everybody around them, those terrorists. We love our country. But being American here is the best place for us.
Thank you, Father Michael.
You're very welcome.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Rosemary Putnam, for 60 years a cultural leader in Lemon Grove, notably as the force behind the Friends of the Lemon Grove Library. Rosemary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Helen. I'm very happy to be here this morning.
Our conversation today centers not on libraries, with which you've had so much to do, but on Pearl Harbor in World War II. How did that earth-shaking event affect you personally?
Well, it certainly did affect me. I have been asked to recall these memories many times, and they're always kind of sad, but today is a happy memory, and I'm going to tell you about what happened with the Pearl Harbor stay and my wedding.
Oh, nice.
My husband had been in Pearl Harbor for the bombing. He'd been there for 1 year. We were engaged, but we had set no wedding date. He had not had the opportunity, you know, to get back home. So that finally came around. And he was going to come home. And he wrote me, which was the way we corresponded in those days, and said, I will be home September in 1941, and let's get married. And I will arrive in San Diego 1 week from the day I got the message that he was coming home. So quick, I ran to the church and spoke to the minister and got him signed up to do our wedding vows and got the church reserved. So that took care of the minister and the church. That Sunday, I got permission to stand up in church and invite everybody in church to come to Dwight and my wedding on the next Saturday afternoon. Everybody clapped, and they were thrilled because we'd gone there forever. And I thought to myself, well, that takes care of all the stamps and all the invitations that I have to write. So I had that done. Next on my list was bridesmaids. And I asked four of my real good friends, and we all had participated in weddings this time of year. They said, what are we going to wear? I said, what did you wear at the last wedding you were in? and every girl had a dress and shoes that matched. And I said, could we have pastel colors? And they compared, and they all chose a dress to wear. So there was my bridesmaids and all their clothes that I did not have to go out and purchase. Previously, during one of my lunch hours, I went up to Marston's. You remember Marston's down on
the famous old department store in San Diego.
Yeah. And during my lunch hour, I thought, I've got to get a wedding dress. The first dress that they brought me, I loved. It fit me perfectly. I gave them a deposit to hold it. And then every Friday on payday, I went up and paid a little bit more on this dress that cost $100.
Wow.
The most expensive dress I had ever owned. So the wedding dress was purchased. And I pretty much had it all together. I didn't have to worry about transportation because my parents lived on 3rd Street, one half of a block from the church. The church was the United Methodist Church on 3rd and Robinson.
Oh, yes.
And it still is there, a big stone building.
Yes.
Beautiful big old building.
Yes.
I had no problem with transportation to the little reception, which was a cake, not a tall one, but just a flat wedding cake. Then everybody walked from the church a half a block down to my mother's house.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had the reception.
Rosemary, you mentioned email. How were you communicating in World War II?
There was no communication except those little printed out form letters. I forget now what they were called.
Oh, yeah.
And
similar
you
to
would
a
get
telegram.
Them. You know, everything was censored. Every word that was written was censored. Yeah. And all he was telling me was that he was coming home. So I got everything all ready. It turned out to be a wonderful September afternoon. We were married from 1941, and he passed away in 95.
My goodness.
So it was a very long marriage,
yeah.
And it was a beautiful family, and I am left with many, many great memories, 3 beautiful, successful daughters.
And a tribe of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. For our listeners, your husband, at the end of his life, was Rear Admiral Ira Dwight Putnam. It's an old name in American history.
Yes, indeed it was. And he was totally successful in with his Navy career and reached the top of the ladder, of which I was very proud. I had a wonderful, wonderful life.
When you were a Navy wife, you were very active early on in education, health, and welfare for Navy personnel. Do you have a particular memory of something you were proud of there?
The Navy League I volunteered my time for, and then a group of Navy wives and our husbands put on a national convention at Hotel Dell. And it was so successful, and the girls all did such wonderful things, that we decided to band together and get a purpose for our being.
Oh.
It so happened that veterans were coming home with great problems where they needed hospital care. And the Navy Hospital, the old Navy Hospital, did not have a speech and hearing clinic because many of the young men had great problems with their speech.
Yes.
So our group that put on the big National Naval Officers Convention all banded together, and we created a speech and hearing clinic, raised the money for the room. And after it got, there's several local girls around here that worked very hard on that.
That's wonderful. Going back to the wedding for just a second, do you still have your wedding dress?
Indeed I do. And I was so proud to lend it to my daughter for her wedding, and it was my youngest daughter. And I still have it, and it's up for anybody can borrow it.
Lovely family heirloom. Rosemary, thank you so much for coming by. That was a wonderful, wonderful memoir.
Better than a sad one. So,
and thank you for listening to The Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. Coming up next, it's the Offbeat Report with Rebecca Williamson traveling off the beaten track to find some fascinating stories from the offbeat to the upbeat.
This is Rebecca Williamson here with East County Magazine, and I'm interviewing Rudy Reyes, who has a variety of accomplishments to his credit, one of which is he's a survivor of the Cedar Fire, and he survived over 70% burns on his body. Can you explain a little bit about the experience you had with the fires?
I'm in the Smithsonian, recognized as one of the worst injured, the hero of the 2003 San Diego fires. Because of that, I've toured and spoken and tried to help a lot of people, and I've become more of an advocate to give back. Because, again, I survived one of the biggest fires in human history.
And then another thing that you also do is you're an advocate for the disabled. Can you explain more on what you've done there?
I've gone through on the disabled level and tried to help people understand that, look, just because I have physical issues doesn't mean my life is over, right? So I've tried to make other people understand that if they see me on TV and they see me doing good things, they can too.
But you're cooking up something else different now. You appeared on the MasterChef TV show. Can you go into a little bit about how you actually were inspired to do it and the whole procedure, the whole timeline of how it happened?
Speaking on the disability level and the inspiration, well, let's be honest. The last winner was a blind lady. She was completely blind, and that inspired me to say, hey, look, if she can do something, I can do something. So when I saw them advertising here in San Diego saying that we're going to come to San Diego and do auditions, I'm going to jump in and see what I can do. So I went online and put in the application, and for the most part, kind of forgot about it. And then the week before the audition, they called me up, and they said that we saw your application, and we'd like to see what you can do, and we'd like to see you come in. We understand that you have burn issues, so we're going to give you VIP access. Well, there I am with VIP access, and I don't know what I'm going to cook for these people. So I'm figuring I'm a rarity. Let's cook them a rarity. And I know how to do Indian tacos, Native American tacos, Indian fry bread.
Rudy, if you could explain a little bit more about your own ethnic background.
Honestly, I like to call myself indigenous. I'm from here. I'm a mix of Mexican and local Kumeyaay Indians. I'm from the Brona Band of Native American Indians. And that makes me as indigenous as you can get. I've got degrees in archaeology. That's my background. I used to get extra credit in college for teaching kids how to make fry bread. So I went ahead and made fry bread and got it to the audition within a half hour. So it was still warm and fresh because I had VIP access. So when I got there and presented my dish, oh, they loved it. They had other judges coming in to try it out because it was such a rarity they'd never had this. Next part of the audition is we line up the people that made it through the first one and get your story. Well, as you can tell, I've got a compelling story. In the personal interview, they ask you more personal questions. Why are you doing this? What are you doing it for? And for me, it wasn't about me. It was about the other people out there to see me and to understand that just because, you know, yeah, I'm burned. Yeah, I'm missing fingers. Yeah, my fingers are fused. They don't move the way they used to. But I can still cook, and I can still do, and I can still make a quality life. And that's what it was about.
And explain a little bit about your products that you brought, and also the recipe, if you would share that.
You want me to give away my recipes?
I do.
Okay. So, again, in making a Native American taco, you got to make the fry bread first. I made the fry bread with, let's say, 2 cups of flour, half a spoonful or a tablespoonful of salt, a little bit of water, a little bit of milk, And you mix that all together. Don't forget some oil, just about a teaspoon of oil. And you mix that all together until it makes a nice dough. And then that dough you flatten out into basically a tortilla. You get some corn oil nice and hot. And you fry it up till it becomes a big poofy bread, right? And then that gets set aside. The meat consisted, for me at least on the show, of buffalo meat. I was lucky in the fact that I sourced it out and they had it for me available. Unfortunately, buffalo meat isn't exactly fatty, so it didn't keep its rendering well when it went through the actual show. But that's beside the point. Then from there, I made a fresh pico salsa. Now that salsa consisted of chopped tomatoes, garlic, onion, yellow pepper cut up into it nice and deep, and then lime juice to make it that savory salsa, along with about a spoonful of salt. That, along with a little bit of lettuce, some aged Monterey Jack cheese, and you put together a taco. Just a generalized taco. So now I put down my bread, some beans, because the beans just adds the stickiness so that your meat doesn't fall off the bread. And then you add the salsa, some lettuce, cheese, and now you got a taco, and just fold it up and start eating.
And how much did you have to prepare? Like how many, the quantity of how many tacos that you did at the audition?
At the audition, I made plenty of tacos. Matter of fact, I made so many bread that I was giving them away to other people to try out because they had never tried it at the auditions. I purposely made it like that to be able to give away and be able to have extra. It's a tradition we do. It's a tradition that goes back to Native Americanness that when you do something like this, you give it away.
And then was it also the same with other people who were auditioning? Did you get to sample some of the other people's foods?
A lot of them weren't. And a lot of them were very quiet and hush-hush about their recipes and techniques because they didn't want you to be competitive with them. You know, this is a big competitive, 100 down to 1. Me, I was the exact opposite. I was there to make friends.
Now, you did the actual audition locally in a major hotel.
Right.
And then what happened after that?
They did the first auditions here in San Diego. So they had to go to all the other cities in the United States to do their auditions before they decided. So we're talking another 2.5 months passed before I actually got a confirmation saying, we chose you. They took us up to LA and we stayed in another hotel there. We were sequestered for about 2 weeks while we did the show. I gotta say, thank God I didn't make it much further because I didn't know these TV shows were as hardcore as they are. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you're not done until 9 o'clock at night filming and taping. You're on your feet the whole time. My toes were going white from bad circulation. I'm glad I didn't stay.
Okay, so you go on the show and you hear the music from the show and that's the go.
Now they're going to let me go and let me cook. And then I was free and I knew exactly what I was doing and I was having fun while I was cooking. The real problem I had is we had a short circuit of an oven and 1.5 hours passed between when I presented to the judges and when I had cooked. My food, for the most part, wasn't going to work and I knew that going in. So I decided on the other end to make it a good presentation at the very least and make it about what I had in my background. The judges loved me. Let's be honest, 2 of them loved my food. The one from New York really didn't, right? And he was just because he's from New York. You kind of expect that. He's got a higher class taste. My food is rustic. We're talking Indian food, right? So
Gordon Ramsay is legendary. What was it like to meet Gordon Ramsay, and was it intimidating?
Don't be fooled by the gentleman. He's not what he shows in Hell's Kitchen. In Hell's Kitchen, he makes himself a monster on purpose. It's Hell's Kitchen. The show I was on was MasterChef. He's really nice. Got to meet him, talk with him, shake hands. He liked me, right? It's just because of the problem we had, he couldn't let me go through. So he chose to allow me to come back if I so choose.
So, do you swap recipes with Gordon? I mean, do you sort of like pick his brain about, hey, Gordon, you know, what can you give to me?
He was very honest with me and told me he had never mastered a fried bread recipe. It's something he had never gotten down and he'd like to go spend some time with Native Americans to get it down. Along with that, Graham Elliott, the bigger gentleman, the other of the three chefs, he loved my food. And he invited me to Chicago to go train with him. So in a few months, I'm planning to go to Chicago and spend some time with Graham Elliott and learn from him.
And what other projects have sort of come to the forefront in terms of what you want to introduce in this culinary line to people with the Native American dishes?
Okay, well, that's the idea there. Look, I come from a background where we have staples. We have certain things that a lot of these other cultures that are right around us have never tried. Like, I'm sure you've never heard of shawi, acorn mush. It's a tradition here in San Diego. And not a lot of people have had it because it's a rarity. I know how to make shawi. It takes a lot of tanning and a lot of effort, but I know how to make it.
And what is in it?
It's acorn, which has been ground down into a fine powder and then tannin leached from it so it doesn't have any of the acids that are in acorns naturally. And then that you turn into basically a flour or a mush to make a bread with. It's a little sticky, but it is good. Every tradition, every culture has their staples. My plan is in the next year or so, I want to go around to these different cultures and learn their staples and then bring them back to our society to be able to teach them to others. That's really the ethno of it, of the food, to try to bring back archaeologically so that we don't lose it culturally.
Now, your show, the episode that you were on, aired recently in June.
In June.
Where would you recommend for listeners to go see it again?
You can find it all over the place. It's on YouTube, Hulu, you name it. I'm Series 4, Episode 2. I was in the first night of the show. So they used me for a teaser, a commercial cliffhanger. I'm well known. I made a lot of fans off of that show. I can't wait to go back now. Every year I go to a gathering of burn survivors. I blew it up for the burn community. So when I go back there in a few months, I'm about to have fun, get to see all my friends, teach them some new stuff, and be like, hey, look what I did for us. Because for someone like me to get on a show like that and to present is good.
So, you have a recipe, a signature recipe that you've taken to the forefront on
Correct.
TV. Now, when you go to the store, when you go around the community, do you get hit up for the recipe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've had people see me two aisles down in a row and kind of stalk me for a little bit. And then all of a sudden come up and be like, did I see you on TV? Yeah, you saw me on TV. I'm that guy. Oh, nice to meet you. How'd you do that? What's the recipe of this? I'm like, oh, okay, you want my right here? I'll write it down real quick for you, right? And don't get me wrong, writing it down isn't going to exactly teach you how to make it. So I've got a Vimeo video that I actually have out there where I've taught, where I made the application for MasterChef and I taught them on that show how to make my fry bread. It's available if you look me up on Vimeo.com. Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O. And that site allows for small people to put up their own local videos just to have it up. It's on there so you can learn how to make my empanadas. You can learn how to make my fry bread because the same recipe I make my empanadas is the same recipe I make my fry bread.
Thank you.
No problem.
You can see more of Rudy's interview and more about Rudy at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they leave Harry?
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Today, we bring you some fascinating facts about our local agriculture. Did you know that San Diego County has more small farms under 10 acres than any other county in America? We also have the 12th largest farm economy in the entire United States out of more than 3,000 counties. San Diego County is the nation's largest producer of avocados and nursery crops. We're the second largest producer of guavas, pomegranates, limes, and macadamia nuts. And we're number 3 in honey production, sweet, and number 5 in lemons, 9th in strawberry production, and 10th in egg-laying hens. We also have the second most farms owned by women of any county in the United States. Farming contributes over $5 billion in annual revenue to San Diego County's economy. Our farmers help us maintain open space and rural character, and all of those fruit trees and other crops, well, they also help sequester carbon to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that can contribute to global warming. Although San Diego County has over 6,000 farmers, 65% are 9 acres or less in size. Our high water costs mean growers often choose products that have a high dollar value per acre, hence some of those exotic crops. And fortunately, our mild Mediterranean climate makes it easy for farmers to grow crops nearly year-round. You can purchase locally grown products at farmers markets, roadside fruit stands, and other locations across our region. If you're looking for East County farmers markets, you can find those in our guide to fresh local foods at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Or for countywide listings, check the San Diego Farm Bureau's website at www.sdfarmbureau.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.